this is Lauren Cattaneo getting started here. First, I just want to thank Barbara Hart and the Battered Women's Justice Project for inviting me. Nothing is more fun to me than to talk about research with folks who actually would be interested in applying it or wrestling with how applicable it is. So this is really a pleasure for me, and welcome to all of you. And I also love to work with Corey in any way that I can. So the title of this webinar, I guess the title that came before the title that I gave it, is a question. And in typical researcher fashion, I will not be providing an answer to that question, but we'll hopefully be complicating the question a lot as I go through and giving us some ways to think about how to move toward an answer. And I'm hopeful that after I speak and Corey speaks that we can have a really good discussion wrestling with some of these issues together and hearing your experiences and expertise as well. Just to give you a sense of where I'm coming from before I launch into the content here, I am, as Barbara mentioned, a clinical community psychologist by training, and I work in a clinical psychology PhD program, but my primary orientation is really community psychology. The emphasis of community psychology is applied research, and in a nutshell, what that means to me is that I've never really had much interest in research that doesn't have a so what to it. I'm too impatient for that, I think. So in that vein, my overarching interest is in the utility of research to make a difference in social problems. And within that large universe, my focus is intimate partner violence, probably because it's an issue that has such far-reaching practical consequences and where I believe that the social response to it makes a big difference. As Barbara mentioned, also in general, my work in intimate partner violence, I'm interested in community responses to victims' efforts to stop intimate partner violence or heal from its aftermath, and what happens in those interactions between victims and those of us who are trying to help them. My goal is to work to make our community responses to intimate partner violence the best they can be, and primarily to learn from victims in our efforts to refine our interventions. In the second bullet here, my perspective on the field of intimate partner violence, my just general thoughts, and I'll have more to say when I sort of come to the end of this talk. I see the field of intimate partner violence intervention as one where there's a huge amount of energy and passion and potential. And many people have described the domestic violence movement as one of the most successful in history. It certainly has brought the issue into the mainstream. It can't be denied as a significant problem. And institutions have been forced to respond to it. But there are a lot of activists and scholars and practitioners that have raised questions about where we've landed. So while feeling a lot of pride over what the movement has done and acknowledging much that's good about what we do and what we've done, there are concerns. So, for example, when research has examined the effectiveness of the things that we do, so arrest or batterer's treatment or civil protection orders or prosecution, the data are really very mixed. There's not an intervention, really, where we can look at it and say that the research is compelling and that here's where we really succeed and we know how to do this in a way that has uniform or really convincing impact. So I guess in sum, my overall orientation is that there's a lot of good energy and a lot of good ideas and a lot of work to be done in understanding what we do that's right and what needs to be modified. So given that overall orientation, the reason why risk assessment has been a focus of mine for some time is its practical relevance. Given the limitations on resources, we need to know where to put those resources, making risk assessment really key for anybody working with victims or perpetrators for that matter. Then second, even if we had all the resources in the world, we wouldn't want to do the same thing for every person, so we need to figure out an appropriate response. Also, if we know that very often we only have maybe one opportunity in having contact with a victim, and we kind of want to do the right thing during that one opportunity, and so having a way to assess what's happening and know what to say becomes important. And so risk assessment then is something that's relevant across contexts with people working with victims, and there's a really compelling, at least to me, need to connect research to practice in this area. So what I'm going to talk about in the rest of this presentation, I'll organize it this way. I'm going to talk about three areas of research on risk assessment and intimate partner violence. Within each of those areas, I'll talk about key findings and key gaps. I'll highlight some examples from my own work, and I want to acknowledge right now that you know, there's a body of work out there that's important and informative that I'm not referencing. I'm happy to steer people toward things if questions come up. And then I will end with kind of pulling that all together for us and where to go from here and try to give Corey a really good springboard. So as probably picked up from my comments in the beginning, my focus here is on victim services and in risk assessment when sitting down with the victim. Obviously, there's overlap with other forms of risk assessment as well come up as I talk. So three sources of information that we have at our disposal when we sit down with a victim. One, risk assessment instruments, to the victim themselves, and then the professional expertise. Okay, so what we do and don't know about risk assessment instruments. There are specific risk assessment instruments that have been designed to assess risk and intimate partner violence. One at least, possibly more out there, that have been specifically geared toward meeting with the victim and having limited access to information about the perpetrator. Others that have been specifically geared toward police officers or other kinds of contexts. And then there are also lots and lots of checklists out there that are made up of risk factors that have come out of research but haven't necessarily been put together in an instrument by a researcher. And so I'm using the term instrument loosely to include all of those kind of checklists and then more formally developed instruments. And the upshot in terms of what we know about these instruments is that they predict better than chance. And we call that moderately well in the literature, but that's basically the take-home point. And I've got a few sites here. The first is a study that I worked on before I added Gattanio, where we looked specifically at the predictive accuracy of the danger assessment, which is Jackie Campbell's tool for assessing lethality. And we looked at the ability for the danger assessment to predict future violence, not just lethal violence, but any kind of violence in a sample of women who were seeking help from the court system, and found that it predicted moderately well. And then their role and colleagues did a large study comparing lots of different instruments. And the results of that study are very nuanced and complex. But again, I think a fair upshot is that the various instruments performed relatively well and better than chance. And then that final citation there was a meta-analysis. So this goes beyond the intimate partner violence context and goes to violence prediction instruments in general. So they're instruments that are used in lots of contexts to just predict violence. And these authors pulled together tons and tons of research evaluating how good these instruments were and came up with the sort of disappointing conclusion that they all predicted moderately well and weren't that different from each other. So that's the upshot, and obviously there's a lot more that one could say there, but I think an important point is that there's no one instrument that sort of rises above the other and says, yes, this is the way that we know what's going to happen. So some key gaps here. The first is really a research-related one, but I think it's important to know as a consumer of research in addition to a designer of research. I did a review a way back looking at studies that predicted repeat violence, and looking at all those results, one of the things that really popped out to me was how much studies over-rely on violence that's officially reported, as opposed to asking victims whether there was repeat violence. And that when you separate those studies, so when you ask what predicts repeat arrest as opposed to what predicts repeat abuse, you find really different things. So that's a really important thing to take note of in consuming research, and for researchers to think about as when designing research, is what kind of repeat violence you're evaluating. And I think, you know, predicting repeat use of the system is obviously a subset of repeat abuse. So that's a really big issue in the literature. That's a limitation. The larger issue, though, that I'll spend some more time talking about is how much these instruments focus on prediction. And the instruments are attractive because they sort of boil down the question in front of us when we meet with somebody and saying, okay, what's the likely, how dangerous is this? But there's some real limitations of that focus. So first of all, risk assessment instruments tell you how the person in front of you or the situation in front of you compares to many other situations and pulls all that data together and says, how similar is this one person to this group of people? That pulling together, that aggregate data, is limited in the extent that it can tell you what this individual person will do. You know, there's no magic in predicting the future here. So the information that you're getting out of that prediction is really limited in terms of that individual case. And then second, maybe even more important than that, is that the focus of people who are intervening is not prediction at all, it's prevention. No one is interested in just sort of sitting back to see what happens. Everyone's interested in changing the outcome or maximizing the likelihood of a positive outcome. So those are a couple of really important limitations to really all the literature that I'm going to talk about, because it all really focuses on this prediction question. The next bullet here points to another question that really hasn't been asked by researchers, and that is, are these instruments even helpful? So whether or not they help us to predict, do they help us to intervene? Do they help victims to do what they're already doing better, protecting themselves, making plans, et cetera? So that helpfulness question has really not been approached by the literature very much. And then finally, the question of how we can take this prediction question, which while it isn't, it's problematic, it's certainly important, how can we integrate it into this larger goal of risk management? So that's a direction that the literature hasn't really gone to any great extent yet. Okay. So the second source of information that we have is obviously the victim. And a few key findings here, and then I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail about a study that I did on this question. Victims assess their own risk all the time. This is sort of an obvious point, but one that I think sometimes gets lost as we begin to focus on, you know, how well other things predict. We forget that the person that we have sitting in front of us is engaged in this pursuit full time, especially if they're living with somebody who is a danger to them. So they are very much immersed in that context. And so it shouldn't be a surprise to us, really, that when the body of research that has looked at whether victim assessments are accurate or to what extent they add to the ability of risk factors or risk assessment instruments in predicting future violence, we find that they actually do. They add something that's unique, and that's pretty clear now. There's a handful of studies that show us that. This next bullet I'll detail in just a second. I worked on a couple of papers that used longitudinal data where we had victims assess risk and then follow them up over time and looked at the accuracy of their predictions. And what we found, the bottom line, is that they did not exhibit any consistent kind of bias in their predictions and that they were moderately accurate. So that moderately accurate refrain starting to sound kind of familiar to you. Tell you a little bit about what this study was, just so that you have a sense of the context. We had 246 women who were seeking help for intimate partner violence at either shelter or a civil or criminal court. We followed them up for 18 months. At that first contact, we measured all the predictors and their assessment of risk. And then at 18 months, we asked if those risks were realized. And we had two questions in this study. One was, how accurate were they in predicting that repeat of use? And then secondly, what predicts increased accuracy or decreased accuracy? And just looking at this little chart here, you can see kind of how we split this up. And we did it a little bit differently than some other studies have, thinking that maybe there were some differences between people who thought they were at low risk and were right versus thought they were at low risk and were wrong, as opposed to kind of combining everybody into one group and saying how accurate, looking at different kinds of accuracy. So if victims in general had an optimistic bias, so if they thought that they were at less risk than they really were, they were more optimistic than they should have been, then you would expect to see a lot of misses. If victims in general have an optimistic bias, you would expect that there would be a larger group here perceiving low risk but being reabused. If they had a pessimistic bias where they think they're at more risk than they really are, you would expect them to perceive high risk and not be reabused. You expect to find more folks over here. And we didn't find that. In general, we found that victims were more often more likely to be right than wrong. So right is here. It's correct. And they didn't have any consistent kind of bias. They didn't overestimate or underestimate their risk in any general way. I mean, not that there wasn't anyone who did that, but in general, that was not the characteristic of the sample. And that's just one example, that study I just gave you. There are others that seem to convene around that same point. So the key gaps in this area in terms of the victim as a source of information, one major one from the research side, is that the studies that look at this question are all looking at help-seeking folks. And, of course, the people who don't seek help may have a very different kind of risk assessment going on because they're not seeking help. So that is an area where we really need more work. And, of course, it's a really tricky one research-wise, much harder to get access to those people because they're not offering themselves up. So that's a key gap in our knowledge. But the bigger one, given what we do know, is that we know that victims are moderately good at predicting their own risk. They don't seem to be systematically biased, at least not when they're seeking help. They're not perfect, but they provide some valuable information that shouldn't be brushed aside. However, we don't really know how yet we should include it. And I'll come back to this in a little bit. It's not an easy question to answer. Equally important, we don't know how their perceptions are influenced by what we say. And we don't know if there are different times when they are influenced in different ways. So if they are perceiving high risk, are they influenced in different ways than when they're perceiving low risk? So that, again, that interaction between the helper and victim coming for help is something that we really don't know a whole lot about in terms of risk assessment, how they influence each other. Did I actually see that one of these authors is on the call? I think I may have. Hello. The very important point that I know Corey's going to spend some time on is the idea that victims are thinking about more than one kind of risk, generally. They're thinking about risk much more broadly than physical violence. And so if we are going to be connecting with somebody who's coming and sitting in front of us and looking for help, we've got to be able to somehow take that into account. And it's not clear yet how to best do that. So the final source of information that I want to talk about is professional assessments of risk. And this is the area that there's not a ton of research in the victim source that I just talked about, but there's even less in the intimate partner violence world about professional assessments of risk. There is a huge and very controversial literature out there just about expert judgment in general, the question of whether mental health experts or other clinical folks can make predictions about danger or really any other kind of expert judgment they're being asked to make, really questioning the accuracy of those judgments. So a really interesting article that came out on this here by Weston and Weinberger and the American Psychologist a few years back talked in general about expert judgment. A couple of things that leap out from their article that are really relevant here. Let me back up just for a second. Many people have suggested that clinical expertise is not worth very much. So there's people kind of on the end of the spectrum on both ends saying that this is really all we should pay attention to and that it's worthless. So that's where some of the controversy comes in. And this is sort of a centrist article that says, look, you know, of course there is value to expert intuition, but under certain circumstances it's better than others. So the circumstances where expert intuition seems to develop best are environments where there are reliable cues related to outcomes, the outcomes that you're interested in, and where there's an opportunity to learn. So ideally, you'd want to be able to see very clearly the predictors you were interested in the person coming to meet with you, and then you'd want to know what happened later on, and over time that would allow you to learn and be a better and better predictor. And, of course, those things are pretty tough to come by, particularly when you have single contacts with many of the people that you meet with, and where relationships are dynamic and noisy contexts. It's kind of hard to isolate the things that we're interested in within those relationships and all the information that we're getting from a client. What this suggests is that it's not that expert judgment couldn't be good or couldn't be valuable, it's that it's particularly challenging in the kind of context where we work. Within the intimate partner violence literature, I'm here now, there is not evidence that expert predictions add above and beyond instruments. So when you look at what a risk assessment instrument says about the level of risk and then you add what the clinician meeting with the person thinks, it doesn't seem like, at least from this one study, it adds above and beyond. But again, that's focusing on prediction. I did a study looking at the comparison between victim assessments of risk and professional assessments of risk. And my interest in doing that was not just looking at, you know, who who has a better prediction, but trying to understand how they are influenced and whether they're influenced differently. And they were. So just a little background here, 169 women, again, in a court context. And there were 5 victim advocates who interviewed victims in an effort to assist in the criminal case, identify needs, and conduct safety planning. And both the victims and advocates rated the risk that the victim faced on a scale of 1 to 10. And we followed up with participants 3 months later. The bottom line is that we found that both of their assessments were connected to continued abuse, so again, moderately accurate, but that different factors influence their risk assessments. And I have the factors listed here. This study is really just a very beginning look at this issue, and I think there's a lot more work that could be done on it. But just to give you kind of some suggestive findings for victims, these are the things that are related to a higher assessment of risk. So when they had more symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, when the batterer was more generally violent, when they were not living with the batterer at the time of the offense, and when there was a higher level of psychological abuse. And for advocates here, you can see that all of the factors except for psychological abuse are different. So for advocates, it was the drug use that the batterer, that they knew about from the batterer, whether the victim and batterer had children in common, and greater levels of physical violence, and then again they share this psychological abuse variable. But I think that the point to take home here, that I wouldn't kind of stake my life on these particular things being the most important influences, is just a suggestion at this point. But what we can see from this is that they are influenced by different things. And so it, again, underscores the need for us to figure out how to best bring both those sources of information together. Okay. So this is a return to the earlier slide on what we do and don't know about professional assessments. So we talked about the general problem of expert judgment. And talked about, let's see, this and that. I think one thing that is still lacking and that I tried to chip away at a little bit in a recent study that I did is the question of what actually people are doing with risk assessments. You have all of this work and the bulk of the literature in this area in the research world looking at these risk assessment instruments and a lot of assumptions about what practitioners tend to do, but really not a lot of information about what they do. And so I did a small qualitative study where I interviewed a group of practitioners in my area and just asked them, what do you do for risk assessment, and had a conversation about the challenges for them and that sort of thing. And just to give you some of the highlights there that were really thought-provoking to me, very few participants used any standardized approach, and in fact, we found we had expected to ask this question of what do you do for risk assessment, get a clear answer, and then move on and talk all about its the challenges and limitations. But in fact, most people said, well, what do you mean? It's and felt it was kind of integrated into everything else they did and really didn't, you know, use any particular instrument that they could name or any particular technique that had come from some easily identifiable source. And not only did generally they not use a standardized approach, but many expected that using such a thing would be disempowering to the victim. So had lots of conversations with people who felt that to sit with the client and go through this list would take power and control away from that client and so would in the end hurt the client whether or not it was a good assessment. And the final thing that I found in this study that really jumped out at me was that there was such a lack of information among these programs about what victims got from the risk assessment practices or what the practitioners got from them, a real lack of evaluation, which is probably related to the fact that they weren't using generally a standardized approach. So what would they evaluate? So some big gaps here, obviously. The assumption that more structure is disempowering is one that should be tested. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And then related to some other things I've been talking about, we don't really know how those professional assessments of risk affect victim thinking or behavior afterwards. And then finally, I've alluded to this already as well, how do we bring that professional expertise, just like the victim expertise, into that risk management process? So I want to finish up here by talking about several different kinds of areas where I think all of this stuff crystallizes. And hopefully we can return to some of these things after Corey speaks. Okay, so risk prediction versus management is the first emphasis that I want to make. A lot of the research, while it might be informative, is not, in some ways, is not really practice applicable. It doesn't really lead us to best practices. And in order to be more practice relevant, I think we need to shift from this focus on prediction to a focus on management, which changes the question of risk assessment. Instead of asking the question, what are the chances violence will occur, the question becomes, under what circumstances might violence occur, and how might we change those circumstances? And actually, you could really replace this violence with the risks of greatest concern to the victim. Drawing on what I said in an earlier slide, violence is often one of an array of risks that someone's thinking about. And this question, under what circumstances might violence occur, really points us toward the need to identify dynamic factors of violence. So instead of identifying risk factors that we can't do anything about, what someone's criminal record is, for example, that's something that exists and isn't changing. Looking at things that we might be able to intervene in, substance abuse is one that often comes up. Okay. Second kind of set of questions that I think emerges from looking at all of this is, how should we use these instruments that exist? They're out there. There's research on them. In the references that I've provided all of you, there's a really good review that just came out. I actually just found it a couple of days ago. I had a momentary panic to make sure that I knew the most recent stuff about risk assessment before doing this talk, and actually found this great article that came out very recently, which is a thorough review of the risk assessment instruments that exist. So they're out there. There's information about them, and they are useful. But we've learned in some of our work to understand the effectiveness of different interventions that how we intervene matters as much and sometimes more than what we do to intervene. We've learned that the amount of voice victims have in the process is important, the amount of control they feel they have, and we don't know how to use instruments in a way that fits with the best how. Second, we don't know about how these assessments influence ongoing decision making, and this really relates to this point here, which is that in general, and I guess this goes really beyond risk assessment, this point that I think we need to view our contributions as a field, and the things, different things that we do for survivors at different points along the way, just as one stop on a long journey that they're already taking. So how does the risk assessment we're doing at this moment fit into this longer journey this person is on? And so kind of pulling all of this together, I think we need to move toward best practices that pull prediction into management and do that in a way that gives the victim voice. And then finally, how can we be both survivor-centered and use our expertise? I think this is a big tension out there. I mentioned earlier a lot of people have sort of raised questions about where we are as a field now that we've increased all of this attention toward this issue. And one of the things that people have really talked about, and I think you had a webinar on this topic not too far back, is that we need to move back toward more survivor-centered practice. This doesn't mean that current practice is not motivated by a desire for victim safety. What it means instead is that the services that we've developed are in many cases driving what we're doing with victims. So we're looking at a menu of what we have that's available and offering it up, as opposed to starting with understanding what the victim needs. So the problem with this, again, is that, come down to the second bullet, a lot of the things that we're offering, the research does not suggest they are uniformly helpful. And so risk assessment, the way that it exists right now, doesn't really have a lot of connection with what we know is helpful. So those how questions I was raising a minute ago. So when I found, for example, what I found in my conversations with practitioners is that their assessments of risk would often lead them to do more or do more faster, but it wouldn't necessarily change what they would do. So they might offer more of their services more quickly. But risk assessment isn't really guiding us toward thinking through what we should offer the victim, building a stronger connection between advocate and client, more closely matching victim goals, et cetera. Now, in saying this, I don't want to suggest that we throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot of things that people do right, I think, in the field. But we don't really know what those things are yet. And so just kind of adding to what I had on the previous slide, I think we need to develop best practices that pull prediction into management, give the victim voice, and integrate advocate expertise. And we need to do that in a way that we are able to evaluate what we're doing. And so I want to just add really quickly here at the end kind of where all of this has taken me in my research. I have felt like there's not a good way to evaluate really this outcome in particular, this notion of victim voice or empowerment that people talk about. There isn't a good way to measure it. And so I came up with a model, and I don't want to hurt your head getting late in the afternoon for a picture like this. But the basic idea here is that victims are involved in an ongoing process of empowerment when we see them. And this is the process that I've defined. So they're setting goals that matter to them. They're carrying out actions. They're watching the impact. And these are some of the things that are changing during that process, their ability to reach their goals, their knowledge about how to reach their goals, their feelings that they're able to do it. So I'm putting this up here because I think we can look at the impact of risk assessment on this process as opposed to looking at just the outcome of how accurate prediction-wise is a risk assessment instrument or a risk assessment technique or a professional. How does it fit into this ongoing process? Does it identify actions in addition to the ones that the victim is already taking? Does it help to identify goals, risks, to crystallize what the risks are that she's most concerned about and think about how to make a difference in them? Does it build her skill in being able to safety plan effectively on her own, et cetera? And so I've gone in the direction of trying to flesh this out and think about how we measure this outcome. And once I've really got that down, we'll return to the question of how different risk assessment techniques impact these outcomes. And I think at this point I will, what am I supposed to say, pass the virtual microphone to Corey to talk about how some of these ideas have translated into Safe Horizons thinking.
All right. Hi, my name is Corey Tax, and right now I'm the Director of Program Practice at Safe Horizon in New York City. My role is to support Safe Horizon programs to set standards for how they help clients. I've been interested in the same kind of questions about research that Lauren has been talking about for as long as I've been in the victim services field, which is about 18 years. How can we use research to guide us in improving the ways we serve victims of crime and abuse? That's a central question for me and for us at Safe Horizon. I'm going to be using the words victims and clients to refer to the people that we serve, and this is because most of our clients are still experiencing violence when they seek help from us, so they may not feel like survivors. But I intend no disrespect to people who prefer the word survivor. So the research that Lauren's been discussing has been instrumental in the direction that Safe Horizon has set for our victim assistance practices, and that's what I'm here to talk about today, how we're attempting to apply this research. We're at the beginning of this process, and we're really excited about where it's going to lead us. Before I talk in more detail about this, I want to give you a sense of Safe Horizon. We operate a wide range of victim assistance programs for all crime victims. We're in the courts, we're in the police precincts, we run the majority of New York City's domestic violence shelters, We run the city's domestic violence, crime victims, and rape and sexual assault hotlines. We have a high volume of clients, nearly 200,000 last year. The majority of our clients are domestic violence victims, but we also serve families of homicide victims and victims of stalking, trafficking, sexual assault, property crimes, child abuse. Safe Horizon is the largest provider of DV services in the nation, and our domestic violence hotline received 135,000 calls last year, and 12,600 unique individuals were calling to request shelter that year. We have over 600 full-time or part-time staff. So now I've given you a sense of Safe Horizon, I want to give you a picture, at least a little bit of a picture of the context within which our clients seek services, how they present to us. Most of our clients are referred by people in positions of authority, so they're not freely choosing of their own volition to seek services. Some are mandated. For example, an ACS worker, child services worker, says that you have to go to shelter or I'm going to take your kids away. Our intimate partner violence victims present with complex needs that often compete with each other, with few resources that they can access, and often either have lost support networks where we're the last resort, or they have networks that are compromising their safety, like a mother who tells the abuser where she is, or a neighbor who kicks the victim out when the abuser comes to the door, that kind of thing. So that's a bit about Safe Horizon and a bit about what our clients come to us in the context that they come to us in. And in telling the story of how we've been influenced by this research, I want to start by stepping back a few years. I was part of a committee of program managers, practitioners, with support from our research and evaluation department at Safe Horizon that was looking at our risk assessment and safety planning practices. We examined existing practices, we looked at current research, and we grappled with the realities of our client work, particularly the diversity of contexts that we work with victims in and the diversity of victimizations that we work with, to try to come up with agency-wide standards for how we could do risk assessment and safety planning. When we found Lauren's research, particularly a chapter she co-authored with Lisa Goodman, which is in the references on this PowerPoint, we knew we'd hit the jackpot. Her research was raising some of the same concerns that we were having and helped us to think through how we were going to move forward. I know that a couple people mentioned what tools could I use or what tools work with client advocates, and that's really where we were, the very question we were, what tools should we use? How can this work in our context? And in response to our, you know, understanding of the research that Lauren's been talking about, we decided that formal risk assessments, the ones that were in existence at the time, like danger assessment, the Mosaic, the SARA, the RSVP, that those kinds of things were not appropriate for use in our work as victim service providers. A good part of that decision was based on that chapter that I referred to and its analysis of risk assessment. A lot of that is part of what Lauren has been talking about when she was talking about the formal, the tools. Some key considerations for us in making this decision. Formal risk assessments are focused on predicting offender behavior, as Lauren's already mentioned, particularly whether the offender will reoffend again. And our victim assistance work is focused on victims themselves and the choices they're facing, the actions they can take on their own behalf, and the interventions they can choose to pursue with a variety of formal resources, including the criminal justice system. Predicting whether the offender will abuse the victim again is not the kind of risk assessment that we could use to assist clients in making informed decisions about what they want to do to address the ongoing and dynamic violence they're experiencing. So that was one of the big considerations that we were thinking about when we decided against formal tools. Another thing we were thinking about was that formal risk assessment methods would not be useful to our practice of victim assistance because they're not taking victim actions into account when they're predicting risk. They're focused on correctly determining whether an event will occur, the violence will occur again, instead of determining what actions a victim might be able to take or want to take on his or her own behalf to reduce the risk, which is a consideration that I know that Lauren also mentioned today. And the last one is also something that Lauren mentioned today, which is that when we listen to victims of intimate partner violence talk about their lives and what they face, it's clear that physical violence is but one of many risks that they're concerned with. Formal risk assessment focuses on predicting physical violence, but our clients are often as or even more concerned with other things, like what the abuser might say when making harassing phone calls today, or whether the abuser would get them deported or file for custody or reveal private information to their mother, whether the abuser would get arrested or hurt him or herself, and whether the abusive person would continue to support them in meeting the needs of their son who's living with cancer. Those are some of the risks that people are weighing, that our clients are weighing. They're grappling with complex, changing, and competing risks that often work against each other. And risk assessment focused on predicting physical violence doesn't address all of that complexity and won't help us to address their needs that are coming from those kinds of risks. What we realized was that we needed something else, a practice that could be responsive to the diversity of our client base and the complex needs that they present with. So we began developing a practice that we called safety assessment that placed victims at the center and respected them as decision makers and experts in their own lives. And we basically didn't have a lot to build on, so we were coming up with it on our own. We saw safety assessment as something that would get us the kind of information we could then use to work together with clients to develop plans to address the risks that they were facing. So we knew from Lauren's research that victims are accurate reporters of the risk in their lives. And more importantly, we knew some of the things that Lauren was just referring to about the importance of victim voice and control in the process. So we knew that victims were more likely to follow through with plans that they helped to create themselves and that were responsive to the things that they were prioritizing in their lives. So we wanted a practice that was victim-centered, that listened to victims and worked collaboratively with them to support them to decide how to address the risks that they were facing. We call this practice Safety Assessment and Risk Management, or as we've been calling it, SARM, and saw the safety assessment feeding into the risk management, which is a lot of what Lauren was talking about thinking about a way to assess risk that would then help do the management part. We thought that we needed plans to address client risk that were tailored to the specifics of that risk and their lives and their priorities. And when we're thinking about risk management, we based a lot of our approach on Lauren's work and on safety planning research, particularly the work of Sherry Hamby, which laid out many protective strategies that intimate partner violence victims use to manage their risks, and on the work of Jill Davies, who proposed a victim-centered approach to safety planning and an advocacy approach to intimate partner violence work that emphasized the need to work with clients who continue to stay in abusive situations and not expect all intimate partner violence victims to leave their abusers. So we defined safety assessment as the part of the interaction that was about gathering information, and the goal would be to gather the information that we would need from the victim so that we could assist the client to develop a plan to address the situation that they were seeking help about. And we defined risk management as the planning period of SARM, the way that we would structure our conversation about what the client wanted to do to address the specific situation they were facing. The goal of risk management would be to work collaboratively with the client to develop a plan that sets forth how the client intends to manage their risk. So as we were developing this practice and thinking about it, as I mentioned, we soon realized that there was nothing out there that we could take off the shelf and copy. So we had to create it ourselves, aided by what research could suggest for us. As Lauren referred to earlier, many victim service providers have moved away from a more victim-centered approach to a more service-defined approach. That's what she was talking about earlier, where the service pathways shape how they work with clients. And this is part of what we needed to address at Safe Horizon and moving forward to a more victim-centered practice of addressing client safety. So while there have been a diversity of approaches our staff are taking with victims, many of our staff have been taking a more service-defined approach, where staff listen to victims with an ear toward what boxes to put them in, what services can help. So I'm listening to the victim and I'm thinking, oh, she'd be a good candidate for shelter. Oh, you know, I think he could get an order of protection. And they're thinking that way. And so the services are driving the approach. How did that happen? How did we get there? Well, some of how Safe Horizon got there is a bigger kind of thing. It's about the pressure from and expectations from the people, the partners that we work with, like law enforcement, the pressure from funders, both in the requirements that they set to us in order to show them that we were doing good work, and also in specific funding streams for particular kinds of services. But on the advocate level, that's not where it comes from most of the time. I think on the advocate level, it comes from our desire for concrete solutions, our desire to feel successful by giving clients something tangible that they can point to say, I helped you. It's hard to get people to shift away from jumping to solutions. Solutions feel good. Staff feel good if they give the client the right solution. They feel like, oh, I've done something. I've solved this problem. And that's also, I think it also serves them in this other way that's about not being able to deal with things that are messy and changing. That if I give you this and now you're done and I've helped you. And so there's a lot of personal investment on the part of advocates in continuing to focus on solutions and focus on service pathways. And because of that, and probably also because of how long people might have been doing that, this concept of what I've been talking about, victim-centered advocacy versus service-defined advocacy, it's really hard for line staff and line managers to understand and to apply to their own kind of self-assessment of what they're doing and what their staff are doing. People think that they're doing client-centered work when they're not. And it's a really hard switch to make and to get. And it's really hard for staff to get why they should put in effort, why they're going to training to learn how to do something that they think they're already doing. They think they're already client-centered. They think they're already putting the victim's best interests at heart, and they're caring about the victim, and that makes them client-centered. And so it's really hard to get people to see the difference between those things. And that's one of the things that we've been facing as we've been thinking about making the shift towards this victim-centered practice. Another piece of that, of what we've been grappling with, is that in the current context of victim assistance work, it's really important to note how hard it is to shift to a more victim-centered approach. So I talked about, like, people's personal motivations, and I talked about organizational motivations around funding and expectations from partners and that kind of thing. But the other piece is that people, all of us, care about victims, and we want to help them, and we want to connect them to things that will help them. And our current service options aren't built for victim-centered practices. They're pretty limited options, meeting very specific needs, most of which are focused on separating the victim from the abuser in the context of intimate partner violence, right? So the client wants to get away, let's say. This is an example. A client comes to a service provider and says, I want to get away from the abuse. And our service system only has extreme options for that. Complete separation, no contact with the abuser, and in the process, isolation, loss of the community and the support system in that community, and a new unfamiliar location to live in. We know that intimate partner violence victims temporarily separate, sleep apart, leave for a few days to stay with family. So they're doing separation that's a little more temporary, a little more short-term, in an informal way, but there are no formal systems to assist them to do that kind of separation. It's all or nothing, which can be really challenging if we're trying to do victim-centered work. And another part of why this is working this way and the context of this is the kinds of pressure, systems pressures that I was talking about. Another piece of this puzzle is that these very same service options that I'm talking about, many of them are longer-term solutions that we're trying to use to address emergency situations. So let's say that client says, okay, I will go to shelter. Even with all of these things about how dramatic a shift this is in my life, there's no saying that she's going to get placed in a shelter, that there will be a bed for her today. Even though the need might be for today, tonight, right now, we have a lot of need and fewer resources than we can use to meet those needs. And so that's another part of this picture that makes it really difficult to move towards a more victim-centered approach. So these challenges have been ongoing in our attempt to move towards this practice. And one of the key things that we've needed to do is to advocate with funders to shift their requirements. And that's an ongoing process of education and advocacy to get things to change so that they could allow for a more victim-centered approach in our work, that we could still continue to get the funding that we need to run our program, but be moving, you know, from a more victim-centered approach in our work. These challenges and influences are part of why we decided to invest so deeply in establishing a shared foundation of client-centered skills for victim advocates. To use to take a client-centered approach to some of the basic components of their work, engaging clients, addressing mandated reporting issues, doing information referral, and most especially assessing client safety. So we went for an investment in this, even given all of the challenges that I've named. We're at the beginning stages of this process. We began foundational training this year, and are currently still in the process of training staff on these foundational skills. I want to talk a little bit about what that training was like and what went into that training and that kind of stuff for you. So the training focused on giving all victim advocate staff a shared set of tools that they could use to listen to where victims are at and what their needs, resources, and priorities are, to assess their risks for the next 12 to 24 hours and find out how they're already managing those risks, to respond in a non-judgmental, respectful, and compassionate way that treats victims as the experts in their situations, and to use their expertise to support victims to make informed decisions about how to increase their safety. We wanted to establish a shared language and support for staff, so we decided to train supervisors and leaders first so that they could support their staff through the training. Because we weren't starting from scratch with new staff, but retraining existing staff to change practices, and particularly to change, you know, just when they thought they were already doing what we were talking about, which I think a good portion of our staff were like, but we're already doing client-centered practice, we needed to focus on reframing the way staff think about their work, about their clients, about their role, about what success looks like, that it wasn't just a shift in how we do things, but in how we think about things. And this training has taken a considerable investment on the part of Supervisor in time and effort and resources. It's consistent with effective training principles for adult learners. For example, it uses specific client examples, addresses different ways that people learn, builds on what they already know, and gives opportunities for application on the job. So let me give you a little more sense of what that means on the ground. We began in the training by getting staff grounded in core skills to support meeting clients where they're at. How do you respond non-judgmentally to clients who are making choices you disagree with? How do you encourage victims to talk without probing too deeply? How do you address the needs of clients who are in abusive situations that they don't want to leave? We broke skills down into concrete behaviors that staff could be trained to identify and practice that could be reinforced. We spaced out the training and asked staff to practice skills in between training sessions. And we built on that framework of core skills by asking staff to apply those skills to assessing immediate risks, the risks that the client faces in the next 12 to 24 hours, to exploring the things that increase the client's risk and what the client's already doing to address those risks, and to finding out what the client's priorities and resources are. We asked staff who worked with clients over time, like in a domestic violence shelter, for example, to look out for a particular set of cues that would indicate the need to assess for immediate risks again and begin a new safety assessment. Because we knew that our clients' lives and risks change frequently and that clients can face immediate risks even within the safe confines of shelter. That safety assessment practice that I just laid out for you is based on the assumptions that are, you know, they're connected to what Lauren's research has indicated, right? That victims are already assessing their own risks and taking steps to address them. That they come to us as one step in a much larger process of responding to the violence in their lives. And our interventions are a small piece of a much larger, ever-changing picture for victims. So in our practice of safety assessment, we see our role as one of engaging clients in conversations about their risks and exploring how that risk is operating in their lives, how it's related to why they sought us out today, what they're concerned about happening soon, what might happen in, you know, immediately, their immediate risks. And once we get a picture of how the risk is working in their lives, we're able to help them connect the dots in what they describe to us about the things that increase their risk and explore their priorities, because it's important that they are the ones that have voice and control. We're getting the information from them. They are setting priorities. And with those priorities established, we can explore what they've already been doing to address those risks, because we're assuming they're already doing things and the resources that they already have in place. I want to wrap up by talking about the process of this and some of what we've realized as we've taken these initial steps. One piece is that sponsorship throughout the agency is critical. If you're engaging in a practice just like the one that we're engaging in, support throughout the agency is huge and hugely important. Another piece is that staff need us to be very specific. They want to know exactly when and how to do a safety assessment, how it fits in the larger context of their work. This meant that we needed to tailor many of the client interaction examples that we were using in training so that they were specific to the group of staff who were being trained. Shelter case managers needed examples of how safety assessment would work in DB shelter, and case managers in our court programs need examples of what safety assessment looks like in a family court client interaction. We'd originally thought that we could use examples from across the agency to train everyone, that everyone would understand what it would look like in a court and a shelter and on a hotline, and that staff would be able to translate those examples to their own programs, but that wasn't working. So we worked with program supervisors to tailor examples to each of the specific programs. And this meant that each program got slightly different content and that we needed to invest more in tailoring each design to the particular program. Another piece that we learned quickly is that staff training needs to be adaptable. We met with logistical challenges around staffing and coverage that created other differences in what was realistic in how staff could be trained. Some programs could only accommodate full-day trainings, for example, while some were able to take part in half-day trainings over a longer period. Another thing that we've clearly gotten out of this is that change takes time and support. Training is an initial step, but making this live in our work means ongoing investment and support at all levels. So in order to make this foundation real, training is just the first step. So that's some of what we've gotten out of this process, and I think at this point we can shift to questions.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Corey.
So I see that Cynthia Hunter asked if I've got a PowerPoint or if I could share the safety assessment we created. So I didn't prepare a PowerPoint for today, so there's nothing I can show you right now. In terms of the safety assessment we created, it's more of a dynamic process than it is a tool. So it's not something that like I could send you a piece of paper and you would see it, if that makes sense. I don't know if there are specific things that folks would want us to share, but I mean I laid out some of the basic principles and what we were trying to do, but there's no, like, it's not a concrete checklist. I know that staff really wanted a concrete checklist, I'll tell you that.
Corey, don't you have haven't you guys written some stuff describing what you do though?
Absolutely, and I can definitely share that. There's a way to share things with people after the fact, right? I'm assuming that there is. I can get something to you, Barbara, and we can make that happen.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay. So I will look through things and get something together to share with folks so that you have something to latch onto.
So let's go to the next question from Lindsay Simmons.
The question is, I'd love to know how advocates are using risk assessment research to effectively change custody laws. Our focus is not on changing laws in this safety assessment process that I was just describing. I'm not sure I know the answer to this. Lauren, do you have a sense?
No, I don't know of research looking at risk and child custody. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I don't know of it.
I mean, I think on the individual level, like, we could think about addressing specific needs that come up for particular clients and kind of, but not on the law level. that's not where our focus is.
I will take this question and this webinar to folks that I know who are now working on legislative change related to custody laws.
Oh, cool.
Ask them if they have considered using the recent risk assessment literature in as a talking point, if you will, or as they develop language for any changes in custody. But I don't think that can be answered now, but I'll take it to folks. And if Lindsay, you have any more questions about that, let me know. Let's move to Angela Trujillo's question about the meta-analysis.
Oh, that's an easy one. Here it is.
And great. So Angelia was right. And there you have it on the screen. That's great. So let's go to the question above that, which is Jones Orr's question. And that is, can you...
Anyone looking at what child custody arrangements are associated with violence from mothers and also children? Some of us are seeing that joint custody is becoming far more prevalent and increasing the danger of both mothers and children. I don't know about research related to that point. Again, doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I'm not familiar with it.
Going into Joan George's question, which is, has anyone assessed how good Gavin DeBecker's mosaic is at risk assessment for battered women?
The research that I know has been done on that is this one, the role O'Sullivan, Webster, and Campbell reference here. This was the study that compared a number of different risk assessment instruments to each other, and it's the only research that I know on mosaic, and basically, you know, in that study, the danger assessment outperformed by a little bit, I think, all of the other instruments, but then it also depended on the context. But the mosaic also did pretty well. But the problem in that study is that, in general, risk assessment instruments are developed to be used in different ways, and they had to standardize in order to compare them. So I'm not sure there's really a good test of mosaic out there where it's actually being used the way that it was designed. And as far as I understand it, the mosaic authors are not terribly open to that. I could be wrong about that, but there just doesn't seem to be a lot of literature being generated about that instrument.
Were you then, the study you were referring to was the Yang study again?
No, so on this references page, it's R-O-E-H-L.
Got it. Fourth from the top of the screen. References too for people who are on the telephone.
Yeah, and it's a National Institute of Justice study, so you just go to their website and you can find the final report on it.
Okay. Then we have a request for a recommendation of expert consultants, trainers, who would travel to and train in Nevada. Any suggestions?
Corey, do you want to go to Nevada?
I don't know. Are they asking specifically for trainings on the formal risk assessment tools? I guess I'm not sure what the training is. Because I think that some of the people who authored those tools are perfectly willing to go out and teach you how to use them.
So, ask Maria, why don't you clarify in chat? Connie asks, I think a question that you may have answered already, what risk assessment tools would you suggest be used?
There's the review that I mentioned, Bowen, B-O-W-E-N, 2011,
yes,
is a review of risk assessment instruments and research on them. And there's really no kind of quick answer to that because some of the nuances in the research that I've been talking about are that instruments seem to perform better in the context for which they were designed. Surprise, surprise. So it depends what you're trying to predict, and what context you're in. So for example, there are particular instruments that are designed for use by law enforcement or to predict lethal violence. The danger assessment, I think, has a lot of good empirical evidence behind it and is designed for work with victims. And I know there's a website for the danger assessment that you can go to and probably find a huge amount of information and probably information on training and consultation.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
Jack was one of the people I was thinking of that would be perfectly willing to go out and train anywhere, I would think.
Yeah. So the danger assessment is the name of that instrument. That would be something to check out. But I would also just look at that review article, and they have – in the article, she's got items from different instruments too, so you can think some more about if there's something that already exists that would be helpful in your context.
One thing I would say is that we looked at the tools and we decided not to use any of the formal tools as victim providers, as victim advocates, that we didn't think that they would work for us.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're asking, my suggestion is to look really critically at whether the tools will work for you.
Yeah.
And I just posted the danger assessment URL in the chat. Let's move on to your phone question. Can you give some examples of national data sources on victim reporting abuse? I think it's maybe the victimization studies that are available also on the NIJ website, but I'm not sure what the question is necessarily asking. Perhaps you can answer instead of me.
I mean, they're just kind of general prevalence studies. The one that people generally cite is Jaden and Thones, TJADEN, and then Thones, I think, is THOENNES. There are some national data sources out there that are very easily accessible. I mean, you could just Google it, prevalence, intimate partner violence, and you'll find.
And that's part of the National Crime Victimization Study. The next question, looking at incorporating all or part for judges, law enforcement, and other court personnel to use during hearings and protection orders.
Looking at incorporating a risk assessment instrument or part of one for judges, law enforcement, and court personnel. And, again, I guess I would combine Corey's comment with my prior comment that there is that review article that lays some of them out for you, but that part of the point of both of our presentations was that these instruments that predict, in our view, are not enough, really, and are not closely enough focused on the survivor's understanding of the risks that she or he is facing.
You also suggested that each of these is tailored for a different purpose.
Yes.
So, for example, the law enforcement police risk assessment tool used in Maryland is really for the purpose of trying to identify which women are at greatest risk potentially, but the goal is then to get them into connected with domestic violence services. The goal is not one of reflection necessarily by the women themselves, but for a very preliminary assessment by police with a follow-up that really urges women to seek and participate in services, and apparently has been somewhat effective in getting women to do that.
That is such a good point. Thank you for adding that. Isn't that that's a danger assessment or a version of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she shortened it and made it something that law enforcement officers could walk around, I think.
Yeah, good point. I bet that's on that danger assessment website also, their Maryland project.
So there's Annette asked a question about whether a social security number is necessary for assessment or intake at shelters. The answer is no. And they shouldn't be asking for them. I mean, it shouldn't be requested, period. Go to Angie's question, how to avoid assumptions about safety that might relax. So you ask questions about safety, and when you get the answers, women then begin to conclude, I need not worry. In the process of doing risk assessment, women reach a conclusion that they're not at risk.
Well, I mean, I think part of what we were working with was this way of thinking about safety assessment where we would hear what the victim described about the risks that they were facing, and then part of that process would be reflecting that back to them and particularly connecting the dots about things that made the risk increase or made the situation worse and be able to kind of reflect that back for the victim so that they could kind of sit with it and hear it and think about what their priorities were in the context of the things that they were telling us, that our role was almost like a mirror so that they could see it and we could draw connections for them. And we saw that as an important kind of first piece of the safety assessment before we started then talking about what the priorities were with the intent to really kind of sit with where the victim was at about what was happening. I don't know about whether that would relax the response. My sense is it likely would give you at least the closest kind of matched response to whatever the level of risk that they were describing was. But
one of the things, Corey, that we haven't talked about, I don't think, on this webinar is that risk assessment should be ongoing.
Right.
So in response to Angie, I think that part of what I would want to do is to say that, you know, it may feel to you today, based on all the circumstances of your life and all that you know about the batterer and the context that you're living in, that the risk that he poses may be low to you, or the risks, other risks in your life may not be significant. However, risk assessment should be ongoing and not just periodic, but that you should continue to assess risk because it will change. It is not stagnant. And I think that's one of the very problematic uses of these tools is that they are a snapshot in time.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And unless victims understand that it's a tool for their own use and assessment that's ongoing, we put them at risk and we give information to all sorts of people in their in the legal and human services system that there is an answer.
Right.
To what it is.
I think one really nice technique that I don't think has been integrated into a tool yet, there's something in the sexual assault field, but is scenario planning, which focuses mm-hmm. on, instead of what's the risk, it focuses on what are the scenarios under which you can anticipate risks coming to fruition, and what aspects of those scenarios can we then talk together about how to modify. So that connects to me because it's kind of forward-looking as opposed to, oh, okay, the risk is X, which might relax their response. Instead, it's, okay, today the risk is X, as you're saying, Barbara, and then what can we imagine happening over time?
Mm-hmm.
And what will you do? Who will you contact, et cetera, or what could we do to manage some of those circumstances?
Maybe what I'll do is condition that people who are on this call do not use this chart as a chart, but use it as a talking point. One of the things that I've done related to risk assessment is create this chart in which I ask survivors to think about all the places that they leave their lives. It's not exactly the scenario idea, but, you know, cars, schools, clubs, employment, and to identify the risks they think that are posed by the batterer in those locations historically and currently, and to look at allies that have historically helped and allies that might be developed in those venues and strategies that have worked and strategies that may need to be improved. And so the whole process of critical thinking, which does much, much more than say this guy's at high risk. It particularizes the risk, and it also particularizes who might be there to be helpful and which strategies have been effective. So I'll send that out, but just don't hand it out as a chart to survivors. It's important to have conversations about these things rather than fill in the blanks.
Can I mention something really quickly?
Sure.
What you're describing also sounds a lot like Sherry Hamby's Vigor. So that's another thing to look at as something that does something similar to what you're describing.
And is that described in any of the references you've given us?
I can send a reference for it.
Yeah,
pretty new.
One of the things that I had wanted us to talk about through this, and we haven't gotten to it, so let's just end because we don't have time. It's a question of assessment with particular groups of survivors or clients. And Melissa Pierce asked a question about assessment with LGBT individuals. And are there particular issues that we might particularly consider that are different in or addition to the assessments we would otherwise do?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
Yeah, if we're doing risk assessment with LGBT individuals, are there additional risks or considerations that we should be considering with these survivors in order to accurately help them figure out the current risk posed?
I think it's a really great question. I can't speak to formal tools, but I can say that thinking about ways to do an assessment of risk that is actually responsive to the specific situations that people are bringing and that doesn't make assumptions. Like one of the key skills that we were really focused on discussing with staff is responding non-judgmentally and responding, and asking questions in ways that don't make assumptions about a lot of things about the situation, that some of those kind of basic premises in terms of victim-centered approach, I think, would be at least an initial piece of this. So I can speak to that part. I'm not sure about, research about specific risk factors and specific things that are particularly high. I don't know, Lauren, if you've got any research that you want to
I guess that I have two thoughts about it. One is that this is one of the critiques of risk assessment instruments as well, is that in general they haven't been normed on a diversity of populations. It's kind of like the most mainstream population or the most commonly service accessing population that the instrument has been normed on. And so you have to be careful in using risk assessment instruments with different populations. So it may be that we don't know how good they are at assessing risk in a population where they weren't normed. So that's one caution. And then just my other thought is that in thinking about what more broadly about that, what risk is, that you'd want to be thoughtful about that with somebody who may have some other concerns. Again, it's common to have concerns beyond violence, but I can imagine that LGBT individual may have an additional set of concerns depending on how out they are or whatever else is relevant for them.
Or how much bias the people in their immediate surroundings have that may make them more likely to give information to the abuser based on that bias that they might not give if the victim and abuser were not LGBT. And I think,
I mean, I'm thinking of risk of losing community, risk of losing relationship with family if someone threatens to out you, losing your job, housing, all of those concrete things that are part of the ways that homophobia and transphobia operate in the world that batterers can play on.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, I would say, probably risks of your own internalized kind of sense of worth in relationship to that batterers also play on. That all of those things are part of what can happen in intimate partner violence in LGBT communities. But, I mean, I think the other piece is that the lack of services, even if you are able to assess risk and feel like you've got a good handle on what's happening in somebody's life, there's less out there. Transgender individuals can't go to most support groups because they're gender-specific and don't accept transgender individuals. A lot of shelters don't accept men. there's a lot out there that are barriers. People face particular barriers because of this as well.
I think before we go, and it's time to go, we have to ask Grace's question, or I'll never live it down, which is, how do you gather and keep the data about risk assessment? And if you do keep the data about risk assessment, I guess why? And doesn't it create risk of harm particularly related to confidentiality and or access to records. So this is really directed at Corey, I think, not...
Sure. Okay. I mean, I think that whether we're doing formal risk assessment or other kinds of risk assessment, or in general that, you know, just keeping client files, which I think most people do for a variety of reasons, that the kinds of risks that you're describing around people accessing the information and confidentiality are a top concern, I would say, for many service providers. And there's something that, we spend a lot of time thinking about at Safe Horizon. It's absolutely a big concern. I mean, I think the utility of keeping the information, which I saw in the question somewhere, is keeping some parts of the information, particularly the things that make the risk worse, for example, or the particular strategies that haven't worked, that kind of information would make it easier to do more ongoing work with someone, so that you're not asking them to repeat those same things again, and you know, asking them to consider an option that they've already tried and rejected because it doesn't work. So that's some of the utility piece. But I mean, I think some of what you're describing really depends on how you keep records in general, and whether they're and what kind of technology you use to keep them, and how safe is that technology.
And I would ask, and why is it necessary to keep that at all? I mean, unless you're doing research, and if you're doing research, then I think it's probably kept a different kind of way.
Without identifying information.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it would be useful to keep some information about what, you know, and I'm speaking from, you know, I work in the research and evaluation department, that in order for us to evaluate whether people are both doing what we want them to do with clients and whether clients are getting the kinds of services that they need or what service gaps might exist or all that stuff, that we need to keep information about what we're doing with clients and what's happening so that we can evaluate how effective we are.
And so there's a potential discussion around that, and time is up. So we cannot pursue that right now. I need to... close this down and say thank you to everybody. The chat has been very rich while we have been having this conversation. So thank you, everybody, for providing information for each other, with each other. I'm most grateful. And thanks both to Lauren and Corey. This has been fabulous. I think I've learned a ton, and I know that I have great deal more to read and learn as a consequence of this great webinar. So thank you again, both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I mean, this is everybody. You've done a great job, and I appreciate it. And I will be putting the chat into an edited version so that people can have it later. And we look forward to having you all participate in future webinars. And so at this point, I think we need to say farewell and be well, and we will talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.